Our guest today is model, writer, and host of The Way We Are podcast, Munro Bergdorf. Munro uses her platform to advocate for inclusivity for all races, all abilities, all sexualities, and all gender identities. She's here to share how mental health can be a work in progress and why mental illness doesn't define you. Plus, why rejecting oppression has been key to her flourishing and how feeling stuck in life can be the start of something magical. Welcome, Munro.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
So I like to kick off with some gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you is, what are you grateful for today?
I'm grateful looking at the news to be safe physically, but also that we live in a world where I feel we're all becoming slightly more enlightened to the way that the world works and to biases that exist, how fragile democracy is and how important it is that we stand up and support each other and share our stories as well in a human way.
Definitely. Yeah, at times like this, we can, like you say, become more aware and actually unite and galvanize around our sort of common challenges as human beings.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, I just think it's so great that we, you know, with the internet and with social media and a more connected world that we're living in, we can share these stories, and that, you know, in previous generations, they just relied on word of mouth, but, you know, we can physically see it now. I think that that's really galvanizing people on the right side of history.
Yeah. And you're obviously playing your part in that. I mean, you're an activist, you're raising awareness. I mean, how would you describe yourself and the work that you do?
I think increasingly less defining myself as an activist. I think that word comes with a lot of pressure. And I think that it comes with a lot of expectation as well. And you end up kind of performing the role of an activist rather than feeling like a human a lot of the time. And I engage in activism, but I'm less and less describing myself as an activist, just because it feels very heavy, especially during these times where, you know, there's so much transphobia in a systemic manner operating within society. And also racism, there's always been racism. So it's, I find it difficult, and it does weigh on me emotionally, mentally. So I think I'm trying to like see myself as a person who engages in activism rather than defining myself as an activist, because it's so absolute sometimes.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. How would you describe yourself then as a human being?
As a human being, I mean, multifaceted, like we all are. I have my good and bad days, but I think I'm a human being that is dedicated to growth, and I'm always trying to educate myself and expand my worldview and make sure that, you know, my blind spots don't play into a narrative of other people's social difficulties. So I just try to be the best person that I can be and, you know, admit that I have faults, I have flaws, as well as great bits as well, like we all do. So I just try to, you know, treat other people how I want to be treated and recognize that if somebody does something that I deem as, you know, not what I would do, then, you know, that is kind of just what makes us human beings, that we all see the world in different ways.
And that perspective, that way of seeing the world, has that grown out of your childhood? Were there like clues as to how you would show up as a human being now back then?
Not really. I definitely had my period of like going off the rails as a kid and as a young adult as well. I think it was only really towards the, like, in my late 20s that I really started to take my mental health a lot more seriously,
yeah,
and be more aware of the situations that I was putting myself in and the people that I had around me, who were supporting me, was I even supporting myself? I think it was really during my late 20s that I started to do the work,
sure,
and started to invest in my mind as well as, you know, physically transitioning.
Yeah. So how do you think about your mental health? So when you use that term, what does it mean to you?
For me, we've all got mental health. Yep. And I think that it's interesting in society how a lot of people conflate mental health and mental illness, just use it interchangeably. And, you know, we've all got mental health, but we don't all experience mental illness. I do experience mental illness. I have quite severe PTSD, depression and anxiety, as well as gender dysphoria, which I don't experience as much now because I've had access to healthcare that's helped that significantly. But my mental health is definitely a work in progress. It's like a muscle, you know, you stop paying attention to it and it wastes away, or it can, you know, it just doesn't work effectively. So I definitely just try to keep an eye on it. I have periods of time where I don't need to think about it and I can just get on with my day and you know, just feel like I'm not mentally ill. And then I have days where I'm very aware that I am, you know, navigating mental illness.
Yeah.
Just need to just, you know, make sure that my healing is a constant evolution, because mental illness can be too. It doesn't stay the same forever. And the way that it manifests can change. So, just a work in progress and a constant evolution, really. And my mental health grows as I grow, and so does the healing.
You said quite a few important things there. First of all, you know, we all have mental health. We all struggle sometimes, but we don't all have mental ill health. So that's important. But also what I took out of that is that you can have a diagnosed mental health condition and you can also experience well-being and degrees of flourishing in your life. So how does that show up for you in your life?
I think a great deal of freedom comes with learning how to live with who you are as a person and understanding that, you know, it's very rare that everybody feels 100% A-okay. And I think, you know, looking out into social media, looking out into the world, people don't always share their worst parts. So it can, when you feel like that, it can feel quite isolating, like you're the only one going through it. So I just try to make sure that I'm always communicating how I feel and that I've got people around me that also communicate how they feel, so that I don't feel like I'm going through it on my own. But also making sure that people are in my life that are there during the bad as well as the good, because it helps you realize that, you know, it may feel like that, but like it's, you know, with the right people around you, you can, you know, stay closer to the rails. I think the euphoria comes with learning to sit with myself and understand that, yes, I don't feel great right now, but there are highs and lows, and it's about managing it. And I get a great amount of satisfaction from managing, you know, the way that my brain works.
You say managing, you've mentioned support. Are there particular things that have worked for you in the past and that work for you today?
Support networks. So, you know, keeping friends around you that inspire you, that support you in your interests and, you know, help you feel seen and validated, heard, but also, you know, give it to you straight. You don't want people that are just like blowing steam up your bum. It's important that you've got real friendships and that's, you know, not always people that tell you what you want to hear. So that, but then also, you know, regularly checking in with my inner child. And thinking about who I was and what I wanted before the world started telling me who I was and what I wanted. especially, you know, navigating a career in the public eye, you constantly need to check in with actually who you are on a base level, because there's so much projection that goes on. So I think it's rolling with the punches, but it's also, you know, kind of standing up against them and just making sure that, you know, I don't let it wash over me. I think it's staying on top of the symptoms before they become, you know, overwhelming.
Yeah.
So when I start to see myself slip, if I start noticing that the house has gone into disarray,
yeah,
or if I'm not sleeping properly, if I'm acting in a frantic way, if I'm feeling that anxiousness with regards to the amount of stuff that I need to do during the day, and then that rolls into my private life, I need to like recognize that this is happening before it becomes a problem. So I think in recognizing those signs, you get to know yourself in a heightened way.
Yeah.
And that gives me a great amount of satisfaction, because it's I feel like I can be on my own team. And it's all well and good, you know, having people to pick you up when you're down, but it's really, it's a satisfying feeling to know that you've got your own back, especially with depression and anxiety, which is kind of your mind working against itself.
Yeah.
When you can trick your mind into being like, you can't get this one through the gaps. Yeah. It's good. I feel stronger than, you know, feeling like I'm in a body where my mind is trying to, you know, put me in a bad spot.
These are the kinds of topics, you know, growth, I see it as flourishing, as containing the bad stuff as well as the good stuff. You know, it's all part of being a human being. These seem to be the kinds of topics that you navigate in your podcast, am I right?
Yeah.
And that's The Way We Are?
Yes.
So can you just tell us a bit more about the podcast?
So The Way We Are is a Spotify exclusive, and I basically go on a journey with my guest, different well-known guests, and all very inspirational in their own right. But we go back to their past, and then we go to their present, and then we go to their future, and just kind of unpick who they are on a base level, and then how that got them to where they are now, and then where they hope to go in the future. We've had everyone from Jade from Little Mix to M&EK to some of the Drag Race queens, and more recently Natalie Emmanuel, an incredible actress. So just people that have achieved really incredible things, but also acknowledging the adversity within that journey. Yeah. And that it's not a linear path, it's all over the place, and how their adversity played a significant role in them understanding who they are as people. And yeah, that's The Way We Are.
Yeah. I'd like to pick up on that in a bit, the adversity piece and it's the role that it plays in our growth.
Yeah.
But first of all, I want to ask you, I mean, you've had amazing guests. One of my favorite bands when I was younger was Skunk Anansie, and I see you had Skin. So that
one of my favorite guests.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
So on that note, who has, and I'm sure you've loved them all, and they're probably all inspiring in different ways. I am going to.
Probably Skin, just because she played such a huge role in my childhood in helping me understand who I was, and recognizing that, you know, difference is beauty and it's resilience and it's groundbreaking and all of the opposite of the things that I was told it was when I was growing up. You know, you weren't encouraged to be different. I wasn't encouraged to be different when I was a kid. To see her succeed and just this magical human being on television when I was a kid, and then getting to talk to them when I'm an adult, and, you know, getting to thank her as well, and let her know, you know, the huge impact that she had on me was really, really important to me. But I mean, I don't necessarily have like a favorite guest because everybody's journeys are so different, but that was a great moment for me personally.
Amazing.
But all of the episodes are great. You should binge them all.
So to come back to that adversity and its relationship to growth and flourishing, I guess in your own life, you know, what role has adversity played in your capacity now to show up the way that you do?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, it's played a massive role. And I say unfortunately because adversity is very much always on other people's terms. So, I mean, I would love to have had more of an active role in my life rather than having to navigate other people's bigotry and ignorance. But I mean, that is the world that we live in, unfortunately, as a marginalized person. You know, we're taught Black history from the perspective of it starting with, you know, slavery. And if anything, that's more white history than it is Black history, because, you know, Black people existed before that, but that was something that was done to us. So very much the same with, you know, being queer or being trans or being a woman. So much of our identity is wrapped up in how we are treated with people that have more privilege than us. So having the words to describe that is something that has been so powerful for me. In having the language to describe misogyny, the language to describe transphobia, and to foot it within society to understand how it functions, and to have the words to describe it, the words to identify it, definitely helped take some of its power away. But yeah, I think all marginalized communities are built often in resistance to the things that want to stop us from flourishing. So in my resistance, I have definitely found my joy. I have in the rejection of oppression, I've been able to flourish. I think it's acknowledging it, it's identifying it, acknowledging it, and letting it go. Because I used to care so much about what you know, racist people thought about my skin. I used to care so much about what transphobic people thought about my gender identity, what misogynists thought about my womanhood. And you can't control that. All you can do is control how you respond and understand what it means for them, because it's a them problem. It's not a you problem.
And this is probably a big question that requires a big answer, but I'm sure you've thought about it. Like, why do you think human beings are typically fearful of people that are different to themselves? Like, what underpins that, do you think?
I think it's fear of the unknown, but also I think it's fear of self. I was talking, I went to a dinner last night with Gamma Magazine, and I was talking to the editor-in-chief, and we were talking about phobia, so homophobia or like misogyny. And, you know, we talk a lot about fear, so like fear of gay people, but gay people are constantly being beaten up. There's not a level of threat there. Fear of trans people, but trans people are the ones being murdered at disproportionate numbers. So it's not a physical fear. So what is it? It's I think it's a fear of how marginalized people make people with privilege feel. It's like racism back in the day, you know, with lynchings and stuff. It wasn't a physical fear, it was a fear of the unknown, and that unknown is a fear of self. So I you know, when people are transphobic to me, I'm like, well, where is this coming from for you? Because I know exactly who I am. But you're the one that has the problem understanding the fact that there's more than two genders in the world. Even if you don't think they are, there are, and there has been forever. So it's, you know, I think a great deal of sympathy comes now that I feel I'm a fully realized healing person. But I'm definitely healed insofar as my gender identity. I don't feel like I need to conform in the same ways that I used to. I don't feel like I need to, you know, double down on, you know, people trying to demand questions of me. I think it's sad when people can't accept people that are different to them. And I think it's very telling about what they think about themselves. It's just, you know, the bully mentality. People that are happy with themselves do not bully people. And people that understand who they are don't berate other people for not understanding who they are as well. And that's the reality.
And that seems to really play out in social media. So what's clearly apparent is that it's not an inclusive world on social media. And social media seems to be a place where a lot of young people, that almost is their world to a degree. And that's obviously a an overstatement, but, you know, people spend a lot of time on social media. They learn from social media. They engage, they express, etc. And then just to see people's comments, it's like, you know, there's a lot of hate, a lot of bigotry, like you say. I'm curious to know, like, the first obvious response is anger. Do you ever feel like compassion for those people, given what you've just said now, because it clearly is a sign of things not being right inside for them? I mean, are you able to access compassion, or is that one step too far?
Compassion as a demographic, I think it's pretty pathetic to, you know, berate people that you don't know online because there's such little repercussions for it. So I think it's pretty sad. I do feel it in that way. I don't feel like a compassion is let's hang out.
No.
I feel like, it's pretty sad to, you know, be sat there on a keyboard and to be taking out your hatred on people that you don't know. That's a sad state of affairs for them. I think social media we've got so far to go with it, and it's scary to think that the younger generations don't know of a world without it. So, you know, my generation didn't grow up with barely the internet. Well, I mean, we grew up with the internet, but it wasn't in the same capacity as it is now. So, you know, I didn't have to deal with online hatred at school, at home as well. You know, I mean, I dealt with it at school, but when I went home, it stopped. So I think I want the younger generations to think about a world without social media. Like, who are you beyond it?
Yeah.
Because there's so much pressure that comes with it, and it can be a great space, but it can also not be. And the pressures that come with it, and, you know, the pressures to just keep up, the pressure to say something at the right time, quickly, with everything that's happening in the world, to be aware of everything that's happening in the world, to constantly be plugged into your news stream, to then check in with friends, to be putting across the right image, it's a lot. So I definitely, you know, I dream of a world where social media doesn't have as much as an impact. I think it's impossible. It's important that we have it, but I don't think it should have the gravitas that it has right now. Because I feel like a lot of people are losing themselves, and a lot of people are losing themselves in a way where they're not actually realizing that they're lost, which is them manifesting itself in our behaviors, which can ultimately result in negativity as well. And I suspect that that's a reason why there's so much trolling, as well as, you know, anxiety and depression and body dysmorphia and all of this stuff. So, you know, I think that we need to be giving social media a lot less clout than it's currently receiving.
And have you changed your relationship with social media over the years?
I mean, I upload, but I mean, the weight that I put on it is significantly less. I'm not checking how many people are liking my posts. I'm not thinking about, you know, when should I post this as much. I'm not, you know, investing as much as I used to in it, because it's just, it's such a fruitless pursuit. It's like, why seek out the validation of strangers when I could be pouring into relationships where people can actually receive that, where I can, you know, of course you can do both, but I feel like it's such an absolutist platform, and it's addictive. You know, it's built to be addictive. So, you know, those moments in bed where I could be, you know, reading, or I could be, you know, getting an hour's extra sleep, or like falling asleep quicker. I'm just much more mindful about how I'm passively consuming and what I'm passively consuming, how my data is being used, you know, how I feel when I put my phone down, and also, you know, the messaging that I'm putting across as well. I'm just trying to get people to think a little bit deeper than just accepting, you know, what social media presents with them.
You mentioned there about people are losing themselves in social media. So, like, I guess the opposite of that is finding yourself. And it seems like a lot of your work, things you're doing, centers around that, like finding yourself, owning yourself, expressing yourself in the world, and co-creating a world that invites people to do that, not the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think social media can definitely help you find yourself. It's just a very slippery slope.
Mm.
So if you're active about your consumption, I think it can definitely help you find yourself. Sure. It can help you find your people. It can provide visibility for you to recognize, you know, parts of yourself and other people. But then also, if you're a vulnerable person that's trying to find themselves, you can end up in pockets of the internet that can easily help you lose yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where, like, radicalization happens. That's where misinformation spreads. That's where, you know, you can go into, like, pockets of the internet that are extremely damaging with body image. Mm. So I think it's being just aware of how the internet functions, not completely rejecting it, not completely rejecting social media, just being aware of the potential of it not being a positive place for you, and you may not see it happening. So just to be active with that understanding.
Awareness, proactive, active, not giving your power away to it, but like having some sense of power over it seems important.
And understanding, you know, how data works, how you know, the algorithms work, how the algorithms function, how they're written. This machine learning that's written by human beings, so that in itself holds intrinsic bias that then exacerbates other problems within society. So I think it's just very you know, it's very important that we're mindful of that, that social media is as much a reflection of society as is a magnifying glass, and it can make problems a lot worse if we're not all careful about how we're using it.
Yeah, I agree. To come back to the idea of owning yourself, expressing yourself in the world, you've written a book, which I know is coming out next year. It's transitional.
And yes.
How to live an authentic life.
Yes.
Tell us more about that.
So the main crux of the book is that we all transition in one way or another, and gender transition is just one of those, you know, experiences of growth and change. But from sexuality to adolescence, love and relationships, race, we all have, and healing and purpose, we all have a journey that is... that begins at, say, A, goes to B, goes to C. It's like a never-ending experience. And I just want people to think of, you know, themselves as in transition, that, you know, none of us stay the same forever. We're all going through a process of becoming. And being transgender is just one way that we become. And, you know, it starts with adolescence, and that's our first transition, going from childhood to adulthood. Sexuality, we don't, you know, a lot of us were raised under the pretense that, you know, sexuality is only, you know, someone's asked their sexuality, they were more likely to say normal. But we've come so far within society that, you know, less people are, like, kind of really identifying with rigid sexuality as much as they used to, especially younger generations. There's the lowest lowest percentage of heterosexual people ever, with more and more young people identifying as queer. So it's just talking about how society changes, how we change within that, and then the internal change as well that goes within that. So
who would you like to read the book?
I'm guessing you'd say everyone. Everyone can get something out of it. I mean, I would love everyone to read it, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think anybody that is feeling stuck, and also people that are struggling with change. So I think those two extremes of, you know, either feeling like you're not changing enough or like you're changing and you're finding it difficult to deal with it. I think that those two people can find great solace in this book, because it's a real champion of change, and how it's also a champion of understanding that when you feel stuck, that's when you're on the cusp. Mm. That's when you're like, when things are about to change. And it's usually when I feel stuck that I'm like, okay, well, this is a great foundation for me to build upon, because I am acknowledging that something isn't right. I'm acknowledging that I don't feel comfortable in this stagnation. So how am I going to build upon that? And I think it's just changing how you think and how you look at situations.
Yeah.
So it is very much a memoir, but there's sociological aspects to it, and also, you know, looking at big changes within society, like feminist movements and civil rights movements, and how we talk about things is such an important point in how we move things forward.
Mm. I mean, it sounds like it can and should apply to everyone. You know, if you consider that life is about change and movement, and stagnation is, let's call it death.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, fluidity versus rigidity and spectrums versus binary thinking and ways of seeing things, those are relevant to everyone and everyone's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Two different degrees.
Yeah, and I think it's also like it offers a great deal of hope to people that are being persecuted on the basis of their difference, or on the basis of that people don't understand them because it's new information, even though a lot of the time it's not. It's just repressed information or suppressed or oppressed information. So, you know, the idea that, you know, stagnation is death is one of comfort, because, you know, people that refuse change doesn't mean that change isn't going to happen. If there's one constant in the world, it is change. So you can either be part of that and embrace other people's change, or you can resist it and then, you know, stagnate and die out.
And how have you stayed firm or strong in your identity? I know that, again, that's fluid and change, but in your, like, maybe your deepest identity as a human being, amongst all of the misunderstanding and misrepresentation, like, how are there ways that you stay strong and firm with that, with who you are?
No, I mean, I haven't always stood strong and firm, unfortunately. And I had a great deal of difficulty finding my core when, you know, I mean, I think for a long time I didn't deal with it. I just kind of just pretended that it wasn't happening and just put it into a box and just kept putting it into the box. But, you know, you can only put so much into the box before it just like opens and everything comes out again. And that's kind of what I was dealing with. And then I burnt out and had severe PTSD from a lot of the things that I went through in the public eye. And I think it's also acknowledging that you don't need to be strong and firm.
Sure.
And I always felt like I had to be, and that's why I was putting it in the box, because I had to have my stuff together, and I didn't feel like I had the time or the energy or the will to interrogate how I actually felt. So I pretended that I was okay, and pretended that, you know, it wasn't happening, pretended that, you know, because I acknowledged what happened, I thought that was dealing with it, but it wasn't. So I think the real test of strength has been not putting it in the box and deciding to confront how I feel, the discomfort that I felt and the sadness that I felt, and face it head on. But in doing that, acknowledging that I'm not okay and that I wasn't okay, and I probably won't be okay for a while until it's 100%, you know, until I've got over that hill. But, you know, I think there's such a pressure to be strong and be okay and all of that kind of stuff. And I don't think any of us are really that strong or that okay. And I think it's just part of being a human being. You know, we all have those moments where, you know, everyone's gone and it's just us. And, you know, how do we sit with ourselves? And some people can more than others. And but we all have that moment where it all becomes a bit too much. And I think it's good to acknowledge that.
Definitely. And as a human being, we have a tendency to want to hide away, push away, block difficult feelings and thoughts. And like you've just said now, often the most self-compassionate way to approach it is actually confront and go deep into them. And I think that's it's very relevant for us right now, given what's happening in the world. Like, it could be easy for us to pacify and just distract, but I think we really need to feel into these emotions to be able to respond the way we're meant to respond.
Especially in like our culture, it's only been very recently that we even talk about mental health. When I first started this career that I have, if you struggled with mental illness or depression, or you took antidepressants, it wasn't something that you talked about, because there was a fear that people would see you as weak or see you as unemployable or a liability or all of these things. And it's been so freeing being able to talk about it. And also, you know, you start to realize, oh, actually, a lot of people are on SSRIs. A lot of people have diagnosed mental illnesses, and they still are, you know, highly functioning. Yeah. Not that you need to be highly functioning, but I mean, the idea that if you've got mental illness, that you can't be highly functioning or that you can't, you know, be busy and successful and talented, all of these things that come with, you know, misinformation around mental illness. I don't think of myself as, you know, I don't carry around my mental illness like I used to, because I don't feel as isolated in it. I know that I can talk to people about it, and I can, you know, lessen the load. I don't need to go through it alone.
Yeah.
And anybody that's listening to this that feels alone in it, you know, this, you'll feel so much better if you talk to somebody about it, or if you find other people that are navigating the same thing. I remember when I was 19 and I first started taking SSRIs, and I had so much shame around that time, and I met a friend who was also taking it, and it just instantly made me feel better.
Yeah.
It made me feel like I wasn't doing something that made me weak or made me whatever. It's just so much easier when you can share your feelings and experiences.
Yeah, I mean, talking about these things openly helps to break down that stigma, like you said, helps to normalize difficulties that we all experience. I believe there's also another aspect to this in terms of how we can break this down further and make it a far more inclusive thing. And that's almost like, and you mentioned this at the beginning, rethinking mental health as not just a set of symptoms or problems, but also it's you know, the most beautiful thing that we have. It's how we show up in the world, and it includes all the difficult, you know, ugly, bad, difficult stuff, but also the you know, the things that help us to connect with each other and bring our best selves into the world. So, like, almost like celebrating mental health.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's a lot to be said about, you know, actively creating an environment that fosters good mental health, like, you know, exercising empathy, compassion, kindness, happiness, and, you know, making sure that cultures and environments are positive rather than, you know, just picking up the pieces when it all falls apart. I think, again, it's, you know, making sure that you that you're creating an environment where people can flourish.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that we're having that conversation, that, you know, work cultures, you know, and toxic work cultures are being interrogated like they have never been before. I think it's, yeah, exactly, it's about making sure that we are you know, each other's keeper as well.
Yeah.
That, you know, you're navigating the world and creating it in the way that you would want to live in it.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that. I think the question needs to shift from, you know, how do we address the problems that our cultures are creating to how can we create cultures that foster flourishing.
Yeah.
And it's a big shift, and it'll inspire different behaviors and ways of relating to each other and so on.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's about, you know, build, like, just creating the world as you want it, and then the problems won't be there.
Sure.
There's no point in just continuously creating the problems. Yeah. The way that this world works, I just don't understand it sometimes.
And so part of that is obviously creating an inclusive culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a question here I'd like to hear your answer to. And I recognize that in asking it, I'm a white, heterosexual male. Mm-hmm. So I recognize what that comes with. But the question is, to create an inclusive, a truly inclusive culture, and this might be an ideal that is maybe a long way off, mm-hmm. but does that ultimately mean transcending things like identifying ourselves by our sexuality, our mm-hmm. race, our ethnicity, mm-hmm. etc., or not? Like, is it? I guess it's probably a both and. We mm-hmm. can honor those things and transcend them. I just wonder what your thoughts are.
I think it's really important. I don't think that we can transcend them until society yeah. transcends them. So I think the most important thing is equity.
Mm.
If we are going along the line of equality, of course, equality is the goal. But if you're giving people that have less the same amount as you're giving people that have more, then that yeah. places are still at a yeah. deficit. So equity is how we get there. Certain communities need more resources. And if we are hoping to build something that resembles equality,
yeah.
then we need to make sure that we are pumping resources, pumping opportunity into communities that for decades, if not, you know, hundreds of years, mm-hmm. have been a place at a disadvantage. So I think it's, yeah, it's that, but also I think it is acknowledging. I think it's important to acknowledge when necessary. It's not always necessary. And it's not always necessary that marginalized people need to be put in the position where they're expected to do that also.
Sure.
So I think it's really about, you know, reading the room. How is this playing into a narrative of equality? And how can we equitably support communities that for hundreds of years have been disenfranchised?
Mm-hmm. So obviously you are, I mean, I don't know if this is the right word, you're passionate about this. So this is your purpose.
Mm.
You live a purpose-driven life, it would seem. Like, how important has this purpose been for you?
It's been really important. But at the same time, I'm writing about this in the book, and I think that sometimes your perceived purpose can become so entangled into your identity mm. that you can lose sight of yourself sometimes, mm. especially when, you know, your purpose is wrapped around the concept of fighting.
Yeah.
And you can become quite burnt out. And I definitely burn out. Yeah. And you can lose sight of who you are at any given time. Mm. And I've been doing this job for a long time. And when you're talking about the same thing all the time, yeah. you yeah. can start to feel like you're living in the past a little bit, and then all of a sudden you're like, well, who am I at this point? Because I know mm. that I'm talking about my past experiences, but I've been doing that for so long that I'm now not really sure about who I am. You forget to live sometimes. So I'm making sure that I'm living outside of my social purpose
yeah.
and thinking a lot more about my personal purpose. And like, what do I want for myself? What would make me happy if all of this went away? Because, mm. you know, I'm very aware that this is my career as well. And there's a thin line between purpose and workaholic.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm just trying to like live purposely as well as act purposefully
mm-hmm.
and recognize that this is my job. But there needs to be other stuff outside of that. Like, what are my interests? What, you know, am I funneling enough into, you know, experiencing like things like love and, you know, what do I want in terms of a family?
Yeah, it's really insightful and it seems like a wise way of approaching this. You don't want to become totally wrapped up in this purpose. And like you said before, like your identity isn't just activism. You're a human being with multifaceted parts of who you are yeah. and you express that in the world.
Mm. I think that we're all kind of forced to present ourselves in 2D. And we're all like kind of just like becoming mini brands, and it feels a little soulless to me. I feel like, you know, you lose the richness of a human being when you do that. Mm-hmm. And we all become either like our worst moments or our best moments, and then people want to tear us down from the top, and it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. I want to live, and I think that really needs to take place off of social media as much as mm-hmm. possible.
So do you have a vision for your life, or do you just want to live and let life unfold for you? Like, or do you have is it both and?
Yeah.
What is your vision for your life?
My vision for my life, I mean, obviously just, you know, happiness. That's the main driving force for me. I mean, very simple pleasures, to be honest. I just want like a big house, you know, lots of kids, lots of animals, to have a career that is fulfilling, but to not, you know, exist for it. I want to feel like I made my stamp on the world, that I inspired other people to be happy and be themselves. I never want to stop enjoying life. And I think that's something that, you know, mental illness has taught me, is, you know, how bad it feels to not enjoy being alive, mm-hmm. and to how scary it is to not be in control of your own mind. So I think those two things are things that are really important to me, to make sure that, you know, I'm enjoying being here, and to you know, make sure that I'm in the driver's seat, that I don't allow an illness to dictate how much I live.
I would think that that's probably what everyone wants for their life, right?
Mm.
Yeah. So we're nearing the end, but I guess I have a question. I mean, there's lots of stuff to be concerned about, obviously, but mm-hmm. are there things in your life right now, or are there people in your life right now that are cause for hope and inspiration for you? Like, what brings you the most hope for the future?
I'm so lucky to have so many amazing people in my life. I have an incredible boyfriend, and he brings me a lot of happiness. Just to be in it, like, I've had like abusive relationships in the past, and I think it's lovely when somebody teaches you how you deserve to be loved, and experiencing that has been a very welcome romance. It's been lovely. Him and just my friends. I'm very, very selective about who I'm friends with, because I think, you know, you become the people that you surround yourselves with in one way or another. Not that we're all, you know, responsible for each other's actions, but I think ultimately you do end up becoming mirrors of each other if you surround yourself with a certain kind of energy. I love my friends and the support that we offer each other, and the encouragement and the understanding in the good times and the bad, and just allow each other to be without the pressure of having to conform to who we should be. In the, you know, there's nothing worse than a relationship which is in competition mm-hmm. with each other. Mm-hmm. There's no competition. It's all about just meeting each other where we're at, rather than the expectations of where we should be. I've taken a lot of time and energy thinking about who's in my life.
Yeah.
And I was actually single for like 4 years before I met my boyfriend. Okay. So I'm very, very conscious about the importance of having good relationships.
That sounds great.
Thank you.
So you've shared so much that I think is relevant and resonant for most people. Mm-hmm. But is there any final thing you want to say or share, like before I say goodbye?
When it comes to mental illness, I think that the worst thing that you can feel is ashamed. Shame is such a killer of joy. It's a killer of action. It's a killer of, you know, progress. So I think the only thing that I can really recommend is doing anything that you can to, you know, feel proud of who you are. You know, mental illness doesn't define you. And for so long, I felt, you know, all consumed by this part of myself that I was massively ashamed of. And there's no reason to feel ashamed. And you'll actually, if you start talking about it with other people, you'll realize how many of the patterns that you think are unique to you are actually a shared experience across the world. And when you start talking to other people that experience that as well, you can figure out ways to better deal with it. And it's about managing rather than, you know, completely rejecting or living in shame and silence. It's about, you know, being vocal and talking to other people that experience the same thing, so you can manage, so you can live with, rather than live a double life. And yeah, I think that that's the only thing that I can advise. Just talk. Sure. Keep talking.
So Monroe, thanks for sharing your what's on your mind, what's on your heart today. I've really enjoyed speaking
with
you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode and another brilliant guest. Flourish is a podcast from Unmind, the mental health platform transforming the world of workplace well-being. To find out more, visit unmind.com or follow us on socials at UnmindHQ. You can also find me, your host, on Instagram at Steve@Unmind. See you next time.